Hello, Europe! We are back. Welcome to another episode of The Europeans, the podcast about current affairs, culture, and life in general on this beautiful, damp continent that we call home. I am Katie Lee. I am a British foreign correspondent based in Paris, and I'm joined by my very good friend on the other end of Skype in Amsterdam, the handsome opera singer, Dominic Kramer.
Handsome? Wow, thanks, Katie.
Do you like it when I call you handsome, or do you feel like it's objectification?
I like it, but I also think it like places pressure on me, and I feel like people are going to Google me and realise that I'm not actually as handsome as you are making me out to be.
You're very handsome.
Oh, stop it.
I've got low standards.
Yeah, apparently. But I also like the description that I'm on the other end of Skype, as if it's like a binary thing.
It's like a piece of string connected by two cups.
It is just like that. That would explain why you have so much trouble using Skype, if that's what you think it is.
I'm really good at Skype. I don't know what you're talking about. How are you?
I'm good, yeah. Although I went to see a piece of theatre here in Amsterdam last night that was racist.
Oh, what happened in it?
Well, it was seven white actors, and they all play various different characters, but there were two of the white women played American Chinese or Chinese people at certain points, and they did it in such an uncomfortable way. It was like with such base stereotypes, and one of them, every time she did it, she stood in a yoga pose or something and spoke in this awful voice saying ni hao, and it was really awkward and uncomfortable. And I was like looking around at people in the audience thinking, like, is this acceptable here? And apparently it is acceptable here.
Oh my God, that's upsetting.
It was a really intelligent production otherwise, and I really enjoyed it. But then there were these few moments where the Chinese characters were there, and I was like, what? How? What?
What was it called? Just so everyone knows to avoid it?
Vergeefons.
Okay, don't know how to spell that anyway.
Also, it was 2.5 hours long without an interval, which should be not allowed.
I would really love it to say on the posters, like, 2.5 hours of pure racism.
Well, it's not. It's probably only, like, 7 minutes of racism within the 2.5 hours. But still, that's too many minutes of racism.
That is definitely too many minutes of racism.
I looked at the reviews and no one has mentioned it.
I feel like you should go and add to the pile then. Go and write one.
Yeah, well, probably even talking about it here is like going to be terrible for my career, because I could end up working with one of these directors and I'm going to be blacklisted from another theatre company or opera house.
What do you mean another one? How many are you blacklisted from already?
What am I doing, Katie? I'm going to have to do podcasting full time. How are you?
I'm good. I'm quite sugared up at the moment. One of our mutual Dutch friends is in town at the moment and bought me a nice big packet of Amsterdam stroopwafels, delicious Dutch syrup waffles, and I've eaten about half of them for breakfast, so that's nice. Oh. And I had a good week because I fulfilled a lifelong ambition this week, Dominic.
Oh, yeah.
I judged a French children's poetry competition, and it was unbearably cute.
Oh, was it in English or French?
It was in English, but like quite sweet little French accents, and all recited by heart, like William Blake and a bit of Shakespeare and stuff. And I was the accuracy judge, so I had to take off marks if they made any mistakes. And I was tough but fair.
Were you like Simon Cowell or Cheryl Cole?
I was like Simon Cowell, to the extent of like having the waistband on my trousers very high up.
Of course, but you always are.
Yeah. But no, it was just really, really cute. And some of the kids were really good. They got on stage and gave this very dramatic delivery, which I think will be competition for you. Maybe you should quit and do podcasting as a full-time career.
Or just kids poetry competitions.
Or just kids poetry competitions.
I think that's probably my level. Anyway, let's get on with the show before you have a sugar crash.
Let's do that. Actually, it's funny you talk about racism, Dominic, because that is kind of what this show is going to be about this week. We have a guest coming up that I'm really, really excited to talk to. Her name is Rocaille Diallo. She is a pretty famous French feminist and anti-racism campaigner. And we're going to be chatting about racism in France and the gap between the French ideal of being a completely racism-free society and, of course, the complicated reality on the ground. But before that, it's Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Who's it been a good week for, Dominic?
It's been a good week for Spotify, who were listed on the stock market for the first time this week and are, for now, the most valuable music company in the world. Now, why is this European news? I hear some of you cry. It is because Spotify is, of course, a Swedish company. The value of the company is moving around a bit following the stock market listing, but it's currently sitting around 26 billion smackers. By smackers, I mean dollars.
Oh, good. So I was wondering what currency conversion you were using.
And on top of that, Daniel Elk, who is the Swedish CEO and co-founder, is, according to NPR, the richest man in the history of music, owning shares worth at least $4 billion.
Not bad.
So they may be valued at this stratospheric height, but they are thought to be planning to continue to be running at a loss well into the 2020s.
That seems crazy to me. Like, how is it not profitable when I give them like 10 euros a month and so do gazillions of other people?
Well, most people don't give them money. Most people have the free version, but it's partly because they can't afford to lose their market leader spot from their competitors, which are much bigger companies like Google, Apple, and Amazon. So they have to keep spending and investing in the company in order to make sure they're ahead of the others, that they don't end up taking profit. So this is good news for Spotify, but it's not necessarily good news for the musicians and record labels, as the cut that they get from Spotify is infamously small. And some argue that the streaming revolution, of which Spotify has been at the forefront, has destroyed the traditional business model and career of the recording artist. Perhaps it's not entirely fair to blame Spotify solely for this, seeing as before them there was much more pirating and the music industry was struggling anyway, and at least now these musicians get a little bit, but there is no question that they could do better and should do better.
It is crazy how little cash the musicians get. I'm just going to give a little shout out to my boyfriend's band, I Said Yes.
Woo!
They've got 1 million plays on Spotify. I am dating a rock star, Dominic. And off that 1 million plays, I think they've made like a couple of grand, like really not very much money. It's peanuts, really.
We're on Spotify now too.
We are indeed. You can listen to us there. And we've got a fun Spotify playlist way back from one of our very early episodes of European rock icons. And I was thinking maybe we could branch out and do like European indie, European rap. There's a whole world of playlists out there.
So we're happy to use Spotify even if we feel it's exploiting musicians. Is that what you're saying, Katie?
Yeah, and that we're also currently being exploited. We haven't seen a penny from our Spotify plays yet.
Who's it been a bad week for, Katie?
It has been a bad week for French commuters. We've just kicked off 3 months of massive strikes on the railways here in France. Strikes being, of course, what France does best. And for a couple of days last week, it really did feel like I was living in some kind of parody of France, because pretty much everyone seemed to be on strike, not just the train drivers, but also pilots at Air France and rubbish collectors and people that work at electricity providers. It was France at its brilliant best, really. The train drivers are on strike because they're really pissed off with President Macron for a quite major overhaul of the rail network, which is going to involve stripping new recruits hired in the future of these benefits, like being able to retire in your early 50s and having a guaranteed job for life. Both very French things, of course. Macron's argument is that this kind of thing is part of the reason that French trains are really expensive to run. The government says they're 30% more expensive than other countries in Europe. And the wider context is that European countries, including yours and mine, Dominic, are set to open up to competition in the next few years when it comes to rail travel. So you could get on a Deutsche Bahn train in Amsterdam, for example.
You can already.
Can you?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we haven't caught up with that yet.
But I think it's only to go to Germany.
Okay, so it goes back and forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's going to be like you could have, I might have got this wrong, but I think you're going to be able to have Deutsche Bahn trains running like domestic routes within the Netherlands kind of thing.
But that happens in the UK. Arriva, who run some of the trains in the UK, is actually already a subsidiary of Deutsche Bahn. So we already have essentially Deutsche Bahn.
Okay, fine. I don't know how much exactly it's going to shake things up. I am not a train expert. We should probably get one on this podcast. But yeah, it's going to be a fairly big deal, I think. This is all set to happen by 2022. Much more competition within Europe in terms of rail travel. The train strikes are a really massive deal for Macron, and some people are comparing it to Margaret Thatcher's moment with the coal miners in the 1980s when they had this massive standoff between the two of them. It's kind of a last stand for the French trade unions, who've traditionally been seen as really, really powerful in France. So there's really high stakes on both sides. Like, both sides are saying who is going to blink first. But in the meantime, it's causing absolute chaos for 4.5 million people who use the French trains every day.
I feel for them. It sounds horrible. And actually, Katie, I was looking at booking a train to come down to you in 2 weeks. And Thalys is so expensive. 120 euros each way.
Yeah, that's nuts. Maybe you should think about doing like carpooling or something.
Yeah, blah, blah.
One thing that's going to be really interesting to watch is that the train drivers aren't the only people who don't like Macron and don't like what he's trying to do. The sort of wider context is that Macron essentially thinks France is like a really flabby country that needs to be more dynamic, it needs to be more competitive, and he really thinks that he has a mandate to change that. So he's announced all of these different reforms to various different things like the labour law, the education system. He's trying to get rid of 120,000 public sector jobs. And as a consequence, there's quite a few different groups pissed off at him who are accusing him of like basically trying to turn France into Britain or America. So there's people on the left trying to urge all these groups to come together into this big anti-Macron movement. We're not really seeing that yet, but we are seeing it kind of a little bit. We're seeing students who don't like his education reforms coming out onto the streets in a couple of cities with the train drivers. And historically, it's kind of interesting because all of this comes 50 years after the massive May 1968 protest movement in France, when we saw exactly that. We saw striking workers, student protesters all uniting on the streets. And some people say we're heading for a rerun of that. So, yeah, watch this space.
Our guest this week is also not that happy with Macron. Rokhaya Diallo is a journalist, writer, filmmaker, and campaigner against racism in France.
So I first got in touch with Rokhaya a few months ago when I wrote about her. She was at the centre of this fairly major race row in France. She got appointed to a government commission, which was nothing to do with race. It was about digital policy. And very shortly after she got appointed, she got withdrawn because she was seen as too controversial, quote unquote, because of her views on race. Now, I should just say from the outset that I don't think Rokhaya's views on race are particularly controversial. I think they're seen as controversial because she lives in France and what she's trying to say about the problems in France are quite hard for quite a lot of people in France to hear, I think.
Yeah, I was quite shocked actually to hear what it was that pissed people off about her saying. So basically it was that she claimed France was institutionally racist, which I think a lot of people would think was a reasonable suggestion.
Or at least one that shouldn't get you sacked.
Yeah, absolutely.
No one seemed to see the irony of the fact that she got sacked from a state body for accusing the state of being racist. I just... Anyway, I don't really want to be seen as a French basher. I do love this country very much. And it's not like there's any country in the world that doesn't have problems with race. I think France has probably a couple of specific problems when it comes to race. Police brutality towards young black men, young Arab men, discrimination against people that live in immigrant suburbs. Those problems as well aren't even unique to France. But I think the thing that's really specific to France is that it's hard to talk about race here because people have such a strong idea of this country as a colorblind country, which is, of course, not true at all in reality. So we're going to have a chat with Rokhaya about that and much more. She's on the line from her home in Paris.
Obviously, you were kicked out of this National Digital Council a few months ago, and the idea of you being kicked out was, I guess, the people who disagreed with you thought, yeah, we're going to discredit this argument that there's any institutional French racism. But actually, it seems like there's been so much international media following that expulsion that, if anything, you could argue that maybe it's put more of a magnifying glass on the fact that there is potentially institutional racism in France. Would you agree with that?
Yes, to me, it was just the demonstration of, you know, what I was trying to show. Saying that there is no institutional racism and choosing to say so by evicting a black woman from a digital council, to me, it just made my point. It really brought much international attention to the fact that France is really uncomfortable speaking about race.
This is one of the things that, as a foreigner, I certainly find very strange. Like, it's very hard to talk about race in France. People will just tell you, no, France isn't a racist country. You want to see racism? Look at America. Why do you think it's so hard to talk about race in this country?
I have heard historians saying that France has always had trouble handling minorities, you know. It was the case with Protestants. It has been the case for a long time with the Jews. And I think that France is a country that is centered on the majority. And the identities of the people who do not belong to the majority, they're not really taken into consideration. And today, having so many various minorities, it makes things difficult, much more difficult for the country. But it's not something that just appeared like a couple of years ago. It has always been the case.
Do you think it's got to do with this idea of, you know, like French people often tell you France is a colorblind society, we don't collect data on ethnicity, but, you know, it's almost literally illegal to collect data on ethnicity. Is it France's idea of itself that causes this problem, maybe?
It's an idea, but it's not that true. Yes, for sure, there is no official data, but when France was a colonial power, it had labels on French Muslims in Algeria. You know, you had the French and you had the French Muslims. So just a few decades ago, it was not in contradiction with the French ideology to label Jewish people or Muslim people. I think that now there is probably and for sure a trauma because of what happened during the Holocaust. Mm.
Do you see any positive change at the moment in France towards feeling like something is being done at all to stop this institutional racism? Or do you think people just still aren't wanting to talk about it?
There is a change in the fact that you have some people who were not visible before who are able to appear in the public debate thanks to social media. All the debates that we're having now about race, they wouldn't even occur if it wasn't for Twitter and for social media. So the change is that someone like me is able to go to the mainstream media and, you know, some people, if they don't agree with what I say, they have to deal with me.
Yeah.
10 years ago, you didn't have any minority who would come public and say there is a problem with the state, there is a problem with the police, and it's something that is institutional.
Can we talk about a couple of the things that you have got in trouble for saying? Because I don't think they would cause as much controversy in maybe a country like England or America as they did in France. Like, for example, you have expressed support for women who choose to wear the veil, which I think in Britain, I can certainly speak for Britain, would probably not be as controversial. But in France, there's this quite strong vein of, within French feminism, of seeing Islam as like a religion that's anti-women. Do you think that French feminism is too white, too middle class? Is that part of the problem?
There is no doubt it's white-centered and it is patronizing. So the mainstream feminists tend to think that they have to save Muslim women from wearing any religious sign and that those women cannot be free while wearing them. So they don't want to see them. They don't want to hear them. They don't want them to have any support. So when you go public and you say, as I said, I am pro-choice, so I support any woman in any choice that she does for her body, and I won't judge. I won't say that the good way to be a feminist is to wear this or that type of clothes. Saying that is seen as being complicit to extremism. It's something that really got me into trouble. Whenever I try to say that I have no issue with a woman wearing a hijab, I am being attacked. And not only by trolls on social media, like I have been attacked by the former prime minister, by some mainstream feminists, very well respected feminists. And it has been on TV, on public debates and things like that.
Yeah. And it's kind of seen through this lens of secularism, which is quite important to a lot of French people. But it looks very strange for me to see headlines like Hokkaya Diallo supports women wearing the veil. It's kind of like, it's so what? You know, it's so weird. Another idea that you've got into trouble for is this idea that non-white people should be able to get together in the same room and talk about racism without inviting white people. And again, this feels like another issue that French people get very upset about because it's seen as like, I don't know, it's against the Republic, it's against Republican ideals. Why does it get them so upset?
People are uneducated about race. Because there was that festival and there were like workshops of people of color who would get together and speak about race, about their experience and, you know, how they could strategize to try just to survive in an environment that is mostly contaminated by white supremacy. And that was such a controversy as it was taking place in Paris. The mayor of Paris was intending to sue them because it was discriminatory to white people.
It's not funny, but it is quite funny at the same time.
It was, and she was supported by one of the leading anti-racist organizations. It was crazy. It didn't make any sense. And, you know, people keep talking to me about the fact that I supported such workshops, such meetings, that don't understand that there is a need for people of color to have safe spaces to speak about what they experience. And the worst thing is that they can understand that it's, you know, it can be the case for people who are alcoholics, who are women. Even women, it's fine, because the mayor of Paris funds an organization which is women only. She doesn't have any issue with that. But when it comes to race, it's seen as being like a subversion to the French ideal of, you know, universalism.
Ugh, that's so strange. You think, like, follow the argument through. It doesn't make sense, does it? If you're happy to do it for women, then also for other minorities. Anyway, so we talk a lot about European identity on this podcast, and we often ask people if it's a concept that they think about or they experience. So I wanted to ask you whether you feel European and whether that is something that you even feel we should fight for.
Yes, I do feel European, especially when I go out of the continent. I have been a board member of INAR, which is the European Network Against Racism. I've been a board member for a couple of years and I'm still working with them. And to me, that was very interesting to think about the oppression of minorities at a European level, because the continent has a history of, you know, colonization, of being part of the slave trade. And thinking of that issue out of the, you know, national borders is something that is really meaningful to me. But even culturally, I feel European because of the history of the continent. And at the same time, I have roots in Africa. So it's weird, because when people think about Europe and Europeans, they think about white people. I relate myself to the European identity, but I can tell that I'm not the kind of person they think about when they think about the European identity.
Yeah, talking about the colonial history of Europe, we often fight for proudness of Europeanness, but actually it makes me think maybe we also should be ashamed of some of our European identity.
I feel that there is something unfair.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents came from Senegal in the 70s, so during the colonial time. But now I was born and raised in Paris, and I feel like I have a passport that allows me to go everywhere in the world. And I have some people in my family that are not even allowed to come and see me in France. They're struggling to just to get visas, to travel, to cross the borders. And I can say, okay, if I was born there, I would be the same and I wouldn't have the right to travel. And the only thing that makes me able to do so is the fact that I was born in a place. And that makes me uncomfortable, because I can tell that it's unfair. And the only reason why Europe, small countries like, you know, the Netherlands, the reason why such countries are so rich is because they have been able to exploit Africa. The only reason is colonization. The continent has taken so much from Africa and is not even able now to support the fact that Africans should be free to travel. You know, if I travel to a place, I don't have to think, am I allowed? Even getting a visa is just something formal. You know, it's not something that is difficult. Having in my family people who don't have the same rights, I can feel that there is something really unfair.
It's amazing how much privilege is attached to this piece of paper that we carry around with us. Okay, I just have one final question for you. Do you think Emmanuel Macron will do anything during his presidency to make France a less racist country?
I would love to say yes. I don't think so. What's interesting is that he's younger than the former president, so he has a certain consciousness of the fact that the country is multicultural. But at the same time, what I saw, you know, being appointed to a council and having had the government being pressured to push me to resign, and having, you know, Emmanuel Macron, the Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, do nothing.
Well, I kind of hope you're wrong, but I worry that you're right.
Yeah.
Maybe the change won't come from him. Like, maybe he will be forced by something that will happen from the grassroots levels, from the society. You never know, but it won't come from him. If he does something, it's because someone made him have no choice.
That was Rokhaya Diallo. You can follow her on Twitter at Rokhaya Diallo, RokhayaDiallo. She is very prolific on Twitter and tweets a lot of interesting things about race and feminism, and not just in France.
Katie, I noticed that you said that you speak for Britain. I think some people might question that, but...
I do speak for Britain. Do you not see it? It's on my name tag.
Oh, really? Did you get that position?
I am Britannia.
Uh, I really had to be careful when looking for happy ending stories this week, because following April Fool's Day, I didn't want to accidentally pick a story that was like some media outlet's hilarious attempt at fooling the audience. And quite a lot of the funny stories did actually end up being April Fool's. Oh, and sidebar, I think the award for the biggest April Fool fail this year goes to the mayor of this French town, Beauvais, who joked that their town would be getting an IKEA.
Oh my God.
Did you see this?
Yes, I did. How tone deaf.
I know. And it was a prospect that, funnily enough, like pleased quite a lot of the residents who believed that it would bring thousands of new jobs and prosperity, aside from the obvious flat pack furniture benefits. Anyway, she was forced to apologize for her prank and said that the joke was meant to, quote, attract the attention of potential investors, including IKEA.
Nice save.
I don't know quite how that works. Anyway, sidebar over and on to this week's real happy ending, which comes from Guernsey, where a father and daughter who were doing some gardening have found parts of a classic car from the 1940s or 50s underneath an old rockery. Yeah, isn't that nice? It's been identified by locals as a Daimler? How do you pronounce that?
Daimler.
Do you know that make?
Yeah, it's really big. It's like almost as big as BMW and that lot, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it actually might be owned by Mercedes now. But there, it's a car make that was very exclusive at the time and was even used by members of the royal family. So like, it's a pretty cool car to find buried in your garden. Now, I chose this as the happy ending because surely it's happy news to find parts of a classic car in your garden with potentially more parts to be uncovered. But the quotes that the BBC got from them don't seem too enthusiastic. In fact, the daughter, Tracy Ward, said that she was, quote, very surprised by the discovery and, ideally, if it's of any interest to anyone, we'd like them to come and take it away. She said that they would take it to the scrapyard if no one came to collect it.
Oh my God, what a waste.
I know. I would be so excited if I found a classic car buried in my garden, even if it was rusty.
Why do you reckon it was buried? Why would someone bury a car? Do you think it was involved in some kind of crime?
That's a really good question, and no one really knows. There's one theory that someone was restoring it and, like, gave up with the restoration and decided just to put a rockery on top of it.
As you do.
But, yeah, maybe the mystery will continue.
Stay tuned. We'll keep you updated on that one.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Europeans. We'll be back next week with more news. We'll probably be talking Hungary, and actually we've got a guest already booked for next week to talk about creative storytelling amongst Europeans. We are available on Twitter. Available on Twitter? That makes us sound like we're for hire. We are. But we are available for conversations on Twitter. We love it when people talk to us.
We really do.
So find us at EuropeansPod.
And we're on Facebook at Europeans Podcast, where we've been posting lots of fun things from around the continent. So you might like it. Check it out. We are growing every week and we're really happy about it. But we would really like to get this podcast into even more ears around Europe and beyond. So I was wondering if you could do us a favour. If you like this podcast, could you tell just one friend to go and listen to it? Because if everybody did that, then we would double overnight. Wouldn't that be amazing, Dominic?
That would be amazing. I mean, if you don't have any friends in real life, like me, then you could always just like do one tweet about it. That would also be amazing. Many of you have done both of those things already, and huge thanks to all of you.
Thank you, everyone. Hope you enjoyed the show, and we will see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye.